July 5th, 2004. Regina, Saskatchewan. 5-year-old Tamara Keepness heads for bed while her mother, Lorena Keepness, goes out drinking, leaving Tamara and her 5 siblings alone at their house. Lorena eventually returns home, but when she wakes up later that morning, she discovers that Tamara is missing. Since Tamara lives in a dysfunctional home, there is suspicion that the adults in the household might know more about her disappearance than they're saying. 10 years later, an anonymous Reddit user posts a photo of a hand-drawn map which they believe is Tamara's burial location, but an investigation turns up nothing, and no trace of Tamara is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and the date of this episode's release, July the 1st, just happens to be the national day of our podcast's host country. That's right, it's Canada Day. As you probably know, due to the events which are taking place in the world right now, I've decided that every episode we release over this 1-month period will cover an unsolved cold case in which the victims were persons of color. So I thought today would be an appropriate date to tackle one of Canada's most serious issues, which has often been described as a national crisis: missing and murdered Indigenous women. In fact, we're going to be exploring a case involving a missing Indigenous girl, the 2004 disappearance of 5-year-old Tamara Keepness. This was originally suggested to me in our Facebook discussion group last month by a listener named Britt, and I thought this would be an ideal time to do an episode because I don't think this has ever been featured on a true crime podcast. Now, unlike many other cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous females, Tamara's disappearance did get a lot of attention from law enforcement and the Canadian media, but it also played a role in opening many people's eyes and helping raise awareness of this issue. Tamara hailed from Saskatchewan's White Bear First Nation before she went missing from her house in the province's capital city of Regina, and to say that she lived in a broken, dysfunctional home would be an understatement. All of the adults in Tamara's life had substance abuse issues and a history of troubles with the law, and on the night she went missing, Tamara and her siblings were supposedly left home alone, even though the oldest child was only 11 years old. While Tamara's family have always believed she was abducted, there has been a lot of suspicion that one or more people from inside that home know the answers about what actually happened to her. Either way, we have now almost officially hit the 16th anniversary of when Tamara went missing, so on this episode, we're not only going to explore her disappearance, but the systemic issues which helped play a role in leading to this situation to begin with. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Tamara Keepness.
Thank you.
Our story begins in Saskatchewan in 2004, and our central figure is 5-year-old Tamra Jewel Keepness. Tamra was originally born on the White Bear First Nation Reserve alongside her twin sister Tanis, and Tamra's mother, Lorena Keepness, would often refer to her as, quote, "my little Einstein." Even though Lorena is only 30 years old, she already has 6 children, including the twins, from 3 different men, and they are all currently living with her in a rather run-down 2-story rental house located on Ottawa Street in Regina. Lorena has long split up with Tamra and Tanis's father, Troy Keepness, though the twins often split their time between the households of both parents. At this point, Lorena is living with her 29-year-old common-law partner, Dean MacArthur, the father of her youngest child, who is only 9 months old. Unfortunately, the relationship between the couple is a very tumultuous one, as they both have addiction issues with drugs and alcohol. In fact, Dean has recently served 3 months in prison for beating Lorena in a drunken rage, though she allowed him to return home following his release. At around 8:30 p.m. on the evening of July the 5th, Lorena and Dean got into another alcohol-fueled argument, prompting him to storm out of the house. Dean eventually returned with some formula he had purchased for the baby, and was accompanied by 33-year-old Russell Sheepskin, a family friend whom he had run into while he was out. Russell was the uncle of Lorena's oldest child, Summer, and often stayed at the residence by crashing in their basement. Dean told Lorena that he and Russell were planning to go out drinking before they left again. Tamra spent the majority of the evening watching television with her siblings before Lorena sent the kids to bed at around 11 p.m. Even though her daughter Summer was only 11 years old, Lorena wanted to go visit a friend of hers who lived about a block away and told Summer that she would be in charge of watching over her siblings. When Lorena went to her friend's place, they spent some time drinking before heading to a nearby store to purchase more alcohol. While on her way back, Lorena briefly stopped by her house at around midnight to check on Summer, and after verifying that everything was fine, she told Summer to lock the doors and not open them for anybody. When Lorena returned to her friend's place, she called Summer in order to give her the phone number and instructed her daughter to call her there if there were any problems. Lorena and her friend then spent the next few hours drinking and becoming heavily intoxicated before Lorena decided to return home sometime between 3:15 and 3:30 a.m. Lorena would later say that when she arrived, she discovered the front door was locked, so she entered the residence by crawling through one of the windows. According to Lorena, she saw Summer and Tamra's twin sister, Tanis, sleeping in the living room, but never actually saw Tamra herself before she fell asleep on one of the couches. Lorena woke up with a major hangover sometime between 8 and 9 a.m. when her own mother, Lois Shepherd, showed up at the residence. Over the course of the next hour and a half, the other children in the house would wake up, but Lorena eventually noticed that Tamra hadn't come downstairs yet. When Lorena sent one of the other children to Tamra's room to wake her up, she would soon learn that Tamra was not there. The family performed a search for Tamra throughout the house and the neighborhood, but after failing to find any trace of her, Lorena called the Regina Police Service to report her missing at around 12:15 p.m. Tamra's older brother, Rain, would later confirm that he had spent the night sleeping on the floor of an upstairs bedroom in between the wall and a pile of mattresses which Tamra slept on. When morning hit, Rain recalled being awakened when he felt the mattresses move, and he assumed it was Tamra getting up, though he did not actually see her. Rain soon fell back asleep, but even though he did not know the exact time he had woken up, he remembered that it was daylight outside. While there were no signs of any forced entry or struggle inside the residence, Lorena had noticed that the back door was unlocked when she woke up that morning, and there was also a broken front window, along with traces of blood on the front porch. In addition, there was evidence that an unknown person had made a spaghetti meal in the kitchen sometime during the night, and it soon turned out that it was Russell Sheepskin. Russell and Dean had gone out drinking the previous night, but when Russell was questioned, he claimed that he had gotten so intoxicated that he blacked out and could barely remember what happened. Russell did recall visiting a bar at the St. Regis Hotel 6 blocks away and had vague memories of drinking a beer at a picnic table across the street. At some point, Russell and Dean went their separate ways, and Russell returned to the Keepness residence sometime between 2 and 3 a.m. He likely prepared the spaghetti in the kitchen, though by his own admission, he did not even remember it. However, Russell did recall seeing Summer, Tanis, and Tamra in the living room, and said that Tamra was sleeping on a love seat. Russell then went out onto the front porch to smoke a cigarette when Dean arrived home in a heavily intoxicated state. Things escalated to the point where Dean physically attacked Russell, punching him through a window and stomping on his head before leaving. Russell claimed that he subsequently left through the house's back door and went to the hospital to get some stitches, but he did not remember if he locked any of the doors or not. Russell would eventually submit his DNA to the police, and it turned out to be a match to the traces of blood found on the porch. As for Dean, he did not return to the residence until hours after Tamra went missing. He claimed that after the incident with Russell, he decided to crash at his aunt's house, located a few blocks away. However, because she had recently moved to a new place, Dean maintained that he kept getting lost and passed out drunk a couple times. As a result, he did not actually arrive at his aunt's house until sometime between 5 and 5:30 a.m. when he fell asleep on her couch. Police tried to corroborate Dean's story about having wandered around drunk during that 2 to 3 hour window, but were unable to find any witnesses who could confirm seeing him during that time period. Anyway, Tamra's disappearance would soon launch one of the largest missing persons investigations in the history of Regina, as hundreds of police officers and volunteers participated in the search for her. The Keepness residence was not situated in a safe area of the city, as it was known for being populated by drug users and sex workers, and often referred to as the quote-unquote low stroll. In fact, the house was located less than half a block away from a halfway house for parolees, and a Salvation Army shelter which provided resources for men who struggled with addiction and psychiatric issues. Tamra's family suspected that she may have been abducted by a pedophile, but even though there were a number of sex offenders who lived in the area and were interviewed by police, none of them stood out as potential suspects. Lorena also told police about a female drifter who had stayed at her house in the past and went by the nickname Big Auntie. She apparently went under multiple aliases and had a tendency to lie about being pregnant. Big Auntie had left the residence after a falling out with Lorena and seemed to disappear from the area around the same time Tamra did. While the lead with Big Auntie did not go anywhere, Lorena and Dean denied having any knowledge of Tamra's disappearance. While Lorena cooperated with the authorities, allowing police to search her residence and providing them with samples of her DNA, both she and Dean became very critical of the investigation and believed they were being focused on too much as potential suspects. They expressed their unhappiness with the Regina Police Service's decision not to issue an Amber Alert until days after Tamra went missing, though the police insisted that the circumstances of her disappearance did not initially meet the criteria for one. Well, it wasn't long before the family started facing additional legal problems. On July the 19th, Dean was arrested and charged with assault for his attack on Russell. Dean wound up serving 6 months in jail, though both men would insist that their altercation had nothing to do with Tamra. When Dean attacked Russell, he apparently said the words, quote, "You keep letting her do that," as Lorena had performed sex work on the streets, and Dean apparently blamed Russell for it. He told Russell that he would go get some friends of his to beat him up if he did not leave the house. There would also later be an incident when Tamra's biological father, Troy Keepness, showed up at the house with a baseball bat in order to confront Dean, and he was arrested for assault, though Dean claimed the whole thing was just a misunderstanding. Nevertheless, only 2 weeks after Tamra went missing, all five of her siblings, including her twin sister Tanis, would be removed from the Keepness residence by social services and placed in foster care. A number of unflattering rumors would circulate throughout the area about Lorena and Dean, including that they sold Tamra off to pay a drug debt. At one point, Lorena got into an altercation in a bar with some women after she overheard them saying Tamra had been sold for drugs, which led to Lorena being slashed twice with a knife on the back of her arm. There was also an incident where a TV reporter was doing a live broadcast on the Keepness' front lawn and addressed rumors about the family, stating, quote, "If not someone in that house, then who?" While members of the family just happened to be watching the broadcast on TV at that very moment, and they responded by storming outside and nearly getting into an altercation with the reporter. A special task force would eventually be assembled to examine the case, and the project would be titled Isquisis Ayishuak Imamayai, a Cree phrase which meant little girl bring people together. In spite of this, the investigation would reach a standstill until an unexpected development occurred in 2014. By this point, the police had doubled their original reward offer of $25,000 to $50,000, and shortly after this announcement was made, a Reddit poster going under the username My Secret Is Out made a surprising announcement. On November the 2nd, My Secret Is Out created a post on Reddit titled Location of Tamra Keepness, Check the Wells, and shared a photo of a crude, hand-drawn map which had been scribbled on a piece of paper. The following day, they returned to post some additional information, claiming that they found this map among their grandmother's possessions following her recent death. According to My Secret Is Out, whenever Tamra's case was featured in the media, their grandmother would often say, quote, "They're searching in the wrong place, they need to check the old wells." This map had apparently been given to the grandmother by her own sister, who drew it based on information which was provided to her by an inmate she visited at a prison in Alberta. By this point, the sister was also deceased, and My Secret Is Out clarified that their grandmother had been suffering from dementia during the final years of her life, so it was difficult to ascertain whether or not her story about the map was true. My Secret Is Out said they wanted to maintain anonymity to protect their family from possible, quote-unquote, organized crime connections, and the only reason they decided to share the map on Reddit was because they had previously attempted to submit this information to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the Regina Police Service, and Crime Stoppers, but never got a response. Unsuccessful attempts were made to contact My Secret Is Out, but they would soon deactivate their Reddit account. Regardless, investigators took this lead seriously, and since the word Muscapeding was written at the top of the map, the drawing was believed to be a layout of a Muscapeding Soto Nation Reserve. In particular, it resembled the Muscapeding 80 Reserve, located near the town of Fort Capel, over 70 kilometers northeast of Regina. Police performed a thorough search of the reserve and checked a total of 21 wells on the property for Tamra's remains, but were unable to find anything and expressed their doubts that the map was an authentic piece of evidence. As for Lorena Keepness, her life went into a downward spiral following Tamra's disappearance as she continued to struggle with substance abuse issues, was evicted from her various residences on numerous occasions, and also became involved in sex work. In addition to having her remaining children taken away by social services in 2004, Lorena would go on to have three more babies who were also subsequently taken away. In a 2016 article published in the Canadian magazine The Walrus, it was confirmed that none of Lorena's children were ever permanently returned into her custody, and by that point, the only child currently living with her was her now adult son, Rain. At one point, Lorena claimed that she lost all of her family pictures when someone threw her stuff into the garbage, so the only remaining photos she has of Tamra are from her missing posters. Over the years, Lorena has continued to have an on-again, off-again relationship with Dean MacArthur, and while they've definitely had their problems, Lorena has always expressed her belief that Dean did not harm Tamra. As for Russell Sheepskin, he passed away on January 1, 2009, at the age of 37. In total, the Regina Police Service estimate that they have investigated over 1,700 tips and interviewed over 500 people. Every year on the anniversary of Tamra's disappearance, an annual barbecue is held at Regina's Core Community Park in order to raise awareness for her case. However, after nearly 16 years, there are still no answers about what actually happened to Tamra Keepness. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Anyway, the treatment of missing and murdered Indigenous females is a serious issue here in Canada. While there is probably no way to come up with a 100% accurate estimate of how many missing and murdered Indigenous females there really are in this country, what is known is that Indigenous women only comprise 4% of the total female population of Canada, but the number of them who have become victims of crime is disproportionately high. As an example, between 1980 and 2014, Indigenous women represented 16% of the female victims in reported homicide cases which occurred in Canada, and the numbers have apparently risen in the years since then. It is also estimated that Indigenous women represent around 10% of the country's total number of missing women. Saskatchewan, the location where today's featured story took place, is the only Canadian province which has systematically reviewed its missing persons files for cases involving Indigenous women and girls. In October of 2007, the Provincial Partnership Committee on Missing Persons released a study which concluded that even though Indigenous women only made up 6% of Saskatchewan's female population, they comprised nearly 60% of their cases involving missing females, which of course would include Tamara Keepness. Just over 1 year ago, a national inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women came to the conclusion that the country's widespread murders and disappearances amounted to a genocide. I touched upon this topic in an episode I released last year about the murder of a young Mikisew Cree First Nation woman named Amber Tuckerow, who went missing in rural Alberta in August of 2010 before her skeletal remains were discovered 2 years later. The case has now become fairly well known in the true crime community due to the release of a recording of a 1 minute excerpt of a cell phone conversation where Amber can be heard speaking to the unidentified man who likely killed her. But for the first 2 years Amber was missing, her case was completely ignored and neglected by both the media and the police, and around this time last year, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police issued a public apology to Amber's family for how they handled the investigation. This entire issue is far too extensive to adequately address here, so much like I did on the Amber Tuckerow episode, I'll instead recommend another true crime podcast produced by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation called Missing and Murdered, which has released a pair of multi-part seasons chronicling an unsolved cold case involving an Indigenous female and explores many of these issues in depth. Now, there are countless cases involving female Indigenous victims which were badly mishandled or outright ignored, but I'm not sure you can say that Tamara Keepness's disappearance was one of them, as it received extensive coverage in the media and the police's full attention since day one. Even though the case is still unsolved after all these years, I think the investigators have probably done the best job they could do and are still committed to finding out what happened to Tamara. However, I do have to wonder how this investigation might have been handled if Tamara wasn't a 5-year-old child. Let's put it this way. If Tamara's mother, Lorena Keepness, had gone missing under suspicious circumstances which suggested foul play, how would her investigation have been handled? Would she have received much attention at all? Or would her disappearance have been ignored and neglected the same way Amber Tuckerow's was the first 2 years she was missing? I think one of the main reasons Tamara's disappearance has had such a profound effect on everyone is because she was a sweet, innocent girl who was trapped in a broken, dysfunctional home, and virtually every adult in her life had substance abuse issues and a criminal history. We had a total of 6 kids living in a small, rundown house, and the upstairs area had a room across the hall from the children's bedrooms, which the adults called the quote-unquote slam room. Lorena told her children they were not allowed inside there because this was the room the adults used to shoot up drugs. We know that Tamara's stepfather, Dean, had drug and alcohol problems and spent time in jail for domestic violence, but her biological father, Troy, he was no angel either, as he also had substance abuse issues, as well as an arrest record for numerous incidents of assault against multiple women, including Lorena. Of course, Russell Sheepskin often crashed at that residence and said that whenever Lorena or Dean were too intoxicated or high to be around the children, they would often leave the house, sometimes for days at a time, and Russell would be in charge of babysitting. Russell was also an alcoholic and had his fair share of run-ins with the law, including arrests for assault, breaking and entering, and forgery. At one point, he was even charged with extorting $150 from his own mother. So this was obviously a terrible environment for Tamra and her siblings to be raised in, and I mentioned earlier that the rest of the children were removed from the household 2 weeks after Tamra went missing. If you go to the Unresolved Mystery subreddit, you'll find a post there where someone dug up a 2009 document from a hearing at the Court of Appeal for Saskatchewan. Even though there are no names listed on this document, and the involved individuals are each referred to by their initials, you can easily figure out it is in reference to the Keepness family, and it's quite harrowing to read their extensive history of issues, as over one 13-year period, there were no less than 53 reports filed with social services, many of which were complaints about Lorena's neglect of the children and her excessive use of alcohol and drugs. I mean, on the night Tamra went missing, all the adults in that household went out and got drunk, and an 11-year-old was put in charge of watching over five other children, one of whom was a 9-month-old infant. Even if no one from the family had any direct involvement in Tamra's disappearance, it's easy to believe that at the very least, their neglect played a role in what happened. However, as tempting as it might be to crucify Lorena Keepness, we have to take a moment to explore the systemic issues that Indigenous people have faced in Canada, which lead to situations like this. Lorena herself grew up in an abusive, dysfunctional home on the White Bear First Nation Reserve, and after running away at the age of 14, she spent time living on the streets of Regina, and often had to steal food from other people's gardens in order to survive. And it's also worth mentioning that Lorena spent 3 months as a student in a residential school, and if you're not familiar with what those are, they're pretty much considered to be one of the most shameful chapters in Canada's history, and it's only within the past few decades that the government has publicly acknowledged their own responsibility for them and apologized. Residential schools were a network of government-sponsored religious boarding schools, which originally started in the 1870s, and Indigenous children would be sent there in order to be assimilated into Christian culture and eliminate all aspects of their own culture. For this reason, the schools were often strategically placed a great distance away from the First Nations reservations where these children came from, so they would often be isolated and disconnected from their own families. The students at these schools were often subject to horrific acts of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, and it's estimated that somewhere between 3,000 and 6,000 children died within their walls. They existed in Canada for over a century, and the last of these schools, which happened to be in Saskatchewan, was not closed for good until 1996. Again, residential schools are another large topic which deserve their own podcast series, but there's a reason why children who attended these schools are referred to as survivors, as many of them would go on to develop psychiatric issues such as post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse problems, which would be passed on for generations in some families. I've seen both Lorena Keepness and her own mother referred to as residential school survivors, and you have to wonder just how much that system contributed to their dysfunctional lives. Now, that's not to say this excuses any of Lorena's actions or neglectful behavior towards her children, and if she was directly responsible for Tamra's disappearance, then she deserves to suffer the consequences for it. But I thought it important to offer some insight into the seemingly endless cycle of poverty, addiction, and violence that many Indigenous families find themselves trapped in. If Tamra had not gone missing and continued being raised in this dysfunctional home, she easily could have found herself going down the same path as her mother. Of course, I have no idea how most of Lorena's children are doing today, since they were removed by social services, but in recent years, it's been reported in some articles that Tamra's twin sister Tanis is attending university. So hopefully, Tanis and at least some of her siblings will manage to break the cycle and go on to live happy, healthy lives. Speaking of which, the fact that Tamra had a twin is one detail which sets this story apart from other missing children's cases. Until I started working on this episode, I never considered the potential complications which could arise from a situation like this, because I can only imagine the police dealing with false tips from witnesses who believe they've seen the missing victim, when in actuality, they saw their twin. In fact, when Dean MacArthur first spoke to the police after he learned Tamara was missing, he actually told them that he had seen Tamara with her grandmother at a neighborhood liquor store earlier that day, but it turned out he actually saw Tanis instead. I've even read a few conspiracy theories online, speculating that something could have happened to Tamara before the night she went missing, and her family covered it up for a while by passing off her twin sister as her. Unlike many other missing children's cases, the police have never released an age-enhanced composite sketch to show what Tamara might look like today, even though she would be nearly 22 years old now. Some people have speculated that one reason for this is to avoid a potential onslaught of false sightings from people who see the now-grown-up Tanis and mistake her for her twin sister, which could be quite traumatic for her. However, the other sad possibility for why there might not be an age-enhanced sketch for Tamara is because the police are 100% certain she's dead. Anyway, now we'll try to figure out what actually happened to Tamara on the night she went missing. It's obvious the police have withheld key details from the public, and while they've stopped short of calling anyone a suspect or person of interest, they have definitely implied that the adults who were living at the Keepness residence during that time period might know more than they're letting on. During the early stages of the investigation, Regina Police Chief Cal Johnston specifically stated this quote to the media, quote, "There were comings and goings from the house that night that remain not fully explained to our satisfaction, and we continue to ask those questions," end quote. There are definitely some inconsistencies in the stories provided by Lorena Keepness, Dean MacArthur, and Russell Sheepskin, but the big question is, are these inconsistencies the result of alcohol impairing their memories, or were they intentionally lying? The most commonly accepted version of events is that Tamara was last seen at the residence going to bed at around 11 p.m. before Lorena left to go drinking at a friend's house. Now, most accounts of this case that you'll find today state that Dean and Russell had already gone out drinking, so Tamara left her oldest daughter, Summer, in charge of watching over the other kids. However, looking back through some of the original newspaper articles, I was surprised to see many of them report that Lorena had actually asked Russell to babysit the children. The original story is that instead of going out with Dean, Russell got blackout drunk and fell asleep in the basement before he woke up in the middle of the night, and shortly thereafter, Dean returned home and attacked him on the front porch. I've watched some old interviews that Lorena, Dean, and Russell gave shortly after Tamara went missing, and they do confirm the version where Russell went out drinking with Dean before they went their separate ways, and Russell returned to the house alone hours later. So I don't know where this story about Russell staying home to babysit the children came from. Was it just inaccurate reporting, or did the three adults actually change their original story at some point? I think that one of the biggest unanswered questions, which stems from the inconsistencies in their stories, is whether or not the house was locked that night. Lorena says she told Summer to lock all the doors and not open them for anyone, yet Russell didn't seem to have any trouble going inside when he arrived sometime between 2 and 3 a.m. Since Russell frequently crashed there, it's possible he had his own key, but this detail has never been made clear. But I know Russell said that after he stepped out onto the front porch to have a smoke and was attacked by Dean, he could not remember if he locked the front door or not, and was also pretty certain that he did not lock the back door when he exited the house to go to the hospital. However, Lorena says that when she returned to the house about 30 minutes to an hour later, the front door was locked, which is why she decided to enter through a window. That doesn't make a lot of sense, but we are talking about heavily intoxicated people who don't always make the best decisions. It's interesting how none of the sources specifically state what window Lorena used, which I think might be significant, since one of them wound up being broken when Dean attacked Russell. There are also differing accounts about the front door from different sources for when Lorena's mother, Lois, showed up later that morning. Some sources state that Lorena had to wake up and unlatch the door for Lois, while others say that the door was already open when Lois arrived. While these details might not be significant, knowing if the doors were locked would help determine the likelihood of an outside intruder being able to abduct Tamara from the house. In addition, we also have Russell claiming that he saw Summer, Tanis, and Tamara all sleeping in the living room together when he was at the house, but Lorena said she only saw Summer and Tanis there when she arrived home about 30 minutes to 1 hour later. But again, we're talking about people who were blackout drunk. If Russell says he could not even remember preparing spaghetti while he was there, can we trust his memory when he says he saw Tamara? Also, even if Lorena is telling the truth, given that Tamara and Tanis were twins, could she really be certain about which twin she saw, especially if she was inebriated? One of the biggest issues I've had with the idea of an outside intruder abducting Tamara is that this was an incredibly small house, and 6 kids were there that night, so the odds of someone sneaking into the residence and being able to kidnap Tamara without alerting anyone seems very unlikely. That seems especially true if Tamara was sleeping in her bedroom on the second floor, but I suppose it would not have been as difficult to pull off if she had been in the downstairs living room. Theoretically, if Russell left one or more of the doors unlocked, someone could have entered the residence and taken Tamara while she was sleeping on the love seat before Lorena got home. I mean, the chances of that are pretty remote, but I guess it's not completely impossible. You'd think the intruder would have to be familiar with the layout of the house, which is why Lorena pushed forward this female drifter nicknamed Big Auntie as a potential suspect, since she had crashed at the residence before. It's unclear if police ever found this Big Auntie, but if Lorena was complicit with what happened, she may have just been pointing her finger at this woman to give investigators a false lead to pursue. Anyway, while I'm willing to acknowledge that the inconsistencies in Lorena and Russell's stories might be the result of alcohol impairing their memories, I'm most troubled by Dean MacArthur's account of his whereabouts that night, as he technically has no alibi for a crucial time period of around 2 to 3 hours. The story goes that when Dean arrived home after some heavy drinking, he attacked Russell on the front porch, and I'm still kind of confused about what brought this on. I know that Lorena sometimes hit the streets to perform sex work, and it sounds like Dean got mad at Russell for letting her do it, though I'm not sure why this escalated into a fight at that particular time. The evidence clearly shows that something did happen on that porch, as a front window was broken, and DNA testing confirmed that the traces of blood found at the scene belonged to Russell, and I'm sure it was verified that Russell went to the hospital to get stitches. However, the part that troubles me is that it's never been confirmed if any of the children in the house reported hearing this altercation. It would be one thing if they were all sleeping upstairs at the time, but it sounds like Summer, Tanis, and possibly even Tamara were sleeping in the living room, which would have been a short distance away from the front window. So were they not woken up by the sound of glass breaking? Dean's account of the next few hours is that he went to crash at his aunt's house, but even though it was only a couple blocks away, he kept getting lost and passing out drunk, which is why he did not arrive there until sometime between 5 and 5:30 a.m. Investigators were unable to find any witnesses who could recall seeing Dean in that neighborhood during that 2 to 3 hour window, but of course, given that it was in the middle of the night, that's hardly damning. But while you can't necessarily disprove Dean's story, if you believe he was involved in Tamara's disappearance, then you can easily assume that he spent this window of time doing something to cover up the crime, such as disposing of her body. I mean, even though there's no direct evidence against Dean, we are talking about a guy with a history of substance abuse issues who had only recently returned home after serving time in jail for domestic violence. I don't know if he would have intentionally harmed Tamara, but if he was returning home in the middle of the night in a drunken rage, things easily could have escalated out of control. However, the real wild card in this case is the account from Tamara's brother Rain, who believed he felt the mattresses beside him move that morning because Tamara was getting up. While Rain could not be certain what time this took place, he remembered that it was daylight outside, so this would have occurred hours after Lorena came home. I don't know how much stock to put into Rain's account, since he never actually saw Tamara, and it sounds like he was half asleep at the time, so it's possible he may have just dreamt the whole thing. However, if Rain's account is accurate, then this places Tamara in the residence when daylight hit, meaning that the consistencies with Lorena, Dean, and Russell's whereabouts throughout the night are not even relevant. Even if you don't believe Tamara was abducted from the house, the alternate explanation which has been presented is that she could have ventured outside on her own without anyone noticing, and a stranger grabbed her while she was walking down the street. In spite of her young age, the idea of Tamara being that adventurous was not unprecedented. There was apparently one previous occasion where Tamara and Tanis were spending the night at their father's home, but managed to leave and walk all the way back to their mother's house on their own. According to Lorena, Tamara was very brave and protective of her twin sister, so she pretty much took Tanis's hand in order to guide her home. So who's to say that Tamara couldn't have ventured outside that morning before something happened? Of course, another rumor which has circulated is that Tamara may have been a victim of sex trafficking, or that her family sold her in order to pay off a drug debt or something. Given what a dysfunctional home this was, I know it's easy to assume the worst about all of the adults who were living there. But aside from some inconsistencies in their stories, it doesn't sound like there is any strong evidence to prove they were directly responsible for Tamara's disappearance, and if there is, the police have never shared it publicly. I will say that if Dean, Russell, and Lorena were as intoxicated as they claimed to be on this particular night, and one or more of them did something to Tamara, it's pretty astonishing that they would have had the wherewithal to dispose of her body so thoroughly that no trace of her has been found in 16 years. I guess the final lead we need to talk about is the infamous Reddit post by the user My Secret Is Out, who shared a hand-drawn map of what they believed was the location of Tamara's remains, and claimed they only did this because law enforcement wouldn't get back to them when they tried to send this information in as a tip. Interestingly enough, this type of thing has happened on multiple occasions during the aforementioned Amber Tuckero case, where someone has gone on Reddit or social media and shared the identity of the person whom they believe to be the mysterious man on Amber's cell phone recording, alleging that they've only decided to go public with this information because law enforcement has ignored them. I mean, I can certainly see the concerns in that particular case, but I really don't see any indication that law enforcement has been negligent or incompetent when it comes to investigating Tamara's disappearance. It seems like they've always attempted to follow up on every lead, and even though there was some skepticism about the legitimacy of this map, law enforcement still performed a search of over 20 wells on the Muscapeding 80 Reserve, but found nothing. So would three different law enforcement agencies really have ignored My Secret Is Out if they tried to pass on this lead? Since My Secret Is Out deactivated the Reddit account, I'm not sure if they were ever identified, and it appears the police no longer believe the map is genuine. Of course, this person's story of how they obtained the map is incredibly convoluted, as it was apparently found in the possessions of their dementia-riddled grandmother, whose sister apparently drew it up based on information they received from a prison inmate in Alberta. But of course, for unknown reasons, it sounds like neither the grandmother nor her sister decided to pass this map on to law enforcement themselves before they passed away. My Secret Is Out mentioned something about preferring to remain anonymous to protect their family from organized crime, but here's the thing. Even if they were legitimately ignored in the past, law enforcement did take the information about the map seriously when it was shared on Reddit and followed up on it. When the search came up empty, why couldn't My Secret Is Out have come forward again, even anonymously, to provide investigators with additional information? It would have been really helpful to know if this person ever found out the identity of this inmate their great aunt supposedly visited, and which Alberta prison they were incarcerated at. Because if this inmate really did provide that information, then that implies they were involved in Tamara's disappearance. Without these follow-up details to flesh things out, it sounds like the map is completely useless. So while this Reddit post did achieve a goal of sorts by bringing Tamara's case back into the spotlight again, I am inclined to think it was some sort of cruel hoax. And even if My Secret Is Out is sincere, and they really did get that map from their deceased grandmother, who's to say the grandmother's dementia didn't make her confused about what the map was for? I guess the credibility of this lead would depend on whether you believe a stranger abducted Tamara, or if someone from her house was responsible. If it's the latter, It does seem odd that they would have traveled over 70 kilometers from Regina to the Musk-Pedy 80 Reserve just to get rid of the evidence. Anyway, from what I've read, it seems like the local gossip around Regina is that most people from the community believe that the answers about what actually happened to Tamara lie inside her former residence. And that very well may be true, but there have been cases in which a dysfunctional, suspicious-looking family have had a child go missing from inside their home, but then it turned out they were innocent all along. As an example, look at the 2012 disappearance and murder of 6-year-old Isabel Celis in Pima County, Arizona. Her family, particularly her father, lived under a cloud of suspicion for years, but in the end, it turned out she really was abducted from her home and murdered by an outside predator, so who's to say the same thing couldn't have happened to Tamara? Obviously, Lorena and Dean have continued to live troubled lives after Tamara went missing, and their relationship has been on again, off again, but they've never wavered about maintaining their innocence. Russell Sheepskin was also suspected of potentially knowing more than he let on, but he passed away only a few years later without revealing anything. If something happened to Tamara inside that home, then I suppose the best chance this case has of reaching a resolution is if one of her 5 siblings saw or heard anything. Remember, they were removed by social services only a few weeks later, and most of them are no longer living in the custody of their mother. There would have been plenty of opportunities for them to reveal anything incriminating, but if they have, law enforcement has remained tight-lipped about it. Overall, there are just too many inconsistencies and unanswered questions to come up with a rock-solid theory about what might have happened to Tamara. But what's indisputable is that even if her family had no direct involvement in her disappearance, Tamara was still trapped in a very troubled, dysfunctional environment. If nothing else, this case did open up some people's eyes about the much larger issue of Canada's mistreatment of Indigenous persons, as Tamara's situation was the result of systemic problems which have plagued them for generations. While Tamara's story has gotten quite a bit of attention, there are a number of other unsolved cases involving missing and murdered Indigenous females which have not, so hopefully more awareness will be spread about this issue and changes will be made. And if there was ever a conclusive resolution in Tamara's case, that might help play a role in achieving that. So if you happen to have any information on the unsolved disappearance of Tamara Keepness, please contact the Regina Police Service at 306-777-6500. That's 306-777-6500. Or you can contact Crime Stoppers at 1-800-222-TIPS. That's 1-800-222-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we released an episode on a final appeal case from Unsolved Mysteries about the controversial conviction of Steve Shores, a young resident from Chicago's South Side who served time in prison for the murder of a security guard, but maintained that he was framed by the real killers. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take this moment to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Lena C., Samantha K., Rachel B., and Jenny G. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. Anyway, like I mentioned in the intro, our podcast is spending the month exclusively covering cold cases in which the victims were persons of color, and I've got a few more episodes like that coming out. So for all of my Canadian listeners out there, I hope you have a happy Canada Day, and for the rest of you, I hope you all stay safe and have yourselves a good week, and we'll see you next Wednesday for another brand new edition of The Trail Went Cold.